You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We are the voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of anyone at KDUX, Richland College, or the DCCD. Today we're going to have a treat, a special treat, at the end of the show. Earlier today I attended a lecture by a professor at the University of Texas at Dallas, because Richland College is celebrating Constitutional Day. So towards the end of the show, it'll be the last 15 to 20 minutes. I will include that towards the ending of the show. Today I really have one, maybe two segments of information I want to cover, mainly to to add to what I said yesterday about the shooting at the Washington Naval Yard. We have now learned, and I'm not surprised about that, about this. What happens when you're in a situation where, for example, people are being shot, you have reports that simply turn out to be wrong. When the shooting was occurring, there were multiple reports in the news. There might have been two or even three shooters. It turns out this was a lone shooter, and that's very, very important, because I was speculating, and I clearly said that if it were three shooters, it looked like that is a team, and it could very well be related to the fact that one, and I don't know from what country, that we could have had a radical Islamic jihadist turning violent, and by direct orders from whoever sent them, to attack a naval facility in the United States, given the fact that the United States has a number of naval vessels, not only in the Mediterranean Sea, but also in the Gulf, that was prepared to launch a missile attack, largely, on various targets in Syria. Well, it turns out that the person has been identified, as we have a single shooter, and I will have when I post my notes for the segment, a lot of information on this, a lot of videos, as well as a graphic, a lot of photographs as well. His name is Aaron Alexis. He was shot after killing 12 people and wounding three others. He was shot and killed the same day. He was recently hired as a contractor by the Navy at this base, and I believe it was in the computer information technology area that he was hired at, and used, now it's not clear, he used some identification, obviously to get on the base he would have needed identification, but he had the gentleman was formerly in the Navy, he was for a time in the Navy Reserves, and he lived prior to moving to Washington for this new job, lived in the Fort Worth area, worked in a restaurant. So, and everyone that, and this seems to be a common situation, everyone that knew him, they were totally shocked that he would ever do something like this. He was supposedly converted to Buddhist, had gone over to, I believe, Thailand to study Buddhism. And apparently something happened. His father said, you know, when he was growing up, he had so-called anger issues. In other words, he could get very, very mad. But what was interesting, he had a history of mental illness, being unstable. He was discharged from the Navy for misconduct. However, still, he was in the Naval Reserves. He quit that position and now was working again at the facility as he was a contract personnel, but as a computer in the computer area. Now, there's certain lessons to be learned. Again, don't jump to conclusions. I always say the first 6, 12, even 24 hours, the rumors are rampant. You're going to get conflicting reports, conflicting descriptions. And that's exactly what happened, because everyone was searching for two or three shooters when there were really only one individual. And he was armed with a AR-15. He also had a shotgun and a pistol. So he came to kill people. And doctors that treat people with these type of conditions say, usually the reason they, one of the things that still remains unanswered, what was his motivation? Why did he do this? And I heard one doctor this morning on another show said, he probably had some reason, but doesn't mean we would understand it. Just in his mind, he was justified. And a lot of time, they're committing suicide, and they're going to take some people with them, and he did. He killed 12 people, and the cops killed. It's basically a death by cops. He also was a video game addict. And I suspect when they get more information, especially supposedly he had been getting some medical help, that we'll find that he was on medication. Because usually it's someone that does have, for lack of a better word, mental problems. They're unstable, is one of the common denominators. The other being medication. They either have gone off their medication, or the doctors have increased either a higher dosage or a lower dosage. All of that tends to be in play. So I won't be surprised if we learn in the future that was the situation. I don't know yet. We haven't gotten any medical information as to where, and he's probably, if he was seeing a doctor, it was probably someone here in the Fort Worth area, or when he was in the Navy or as a reservist, maybe he was treated. I don't know, but that was key. Once you have the identification and the photograph, and I've posted his photograph online as well as a map of the Navy Yard to give you better idea, and probably half a dozen or more videos, and you can see the story changes over time. First there are two or three people killed, and six people killed. So, and you had policemen, you have first responders coming, and the problem with this one, apparently he was dressed in, looked like a uniform, and because of that, you have a lot of Navy, enlisted and as well as officers there. The first responders don't know who the shooters are, other than they have some information. He was in the Naval Sea Systems Command headquarters, and it's circled in red on the map that I provided. And it's not too far from Congress. It's only a couple of miles from Capitol Hill. And the same thing with the Washington Monument and the National Mall. It's also not too far, a little further off, is the Lincoln Memorial and the White House. So you had a lot of police responding, D.C. police, as well as FBI, who were the lead in this case. I suspect within a couple of days, if not a week, we'll learn a little bit more about him. It sounds like a situation where he snapped. I hold people that do this responsible. This is an evil act, and the tragedy is this is senseless deaths. Apparently, in the past, they thought he was discriminated against. But that's no justification to kill people. And unless he left some information either on a computer or written something down, I wouldn't be surprised if we never really know the real reason why he did this. Sometimes it's work-related, that he might have had an argument or problems with supervisors. But again, that's speculation on my part. This is a new employee. When you're a new employee, it can be tough initially adjusting to it, but you move from Fort Worth to Washington, you're in a new job, And the first couple of months, first year even, you might have issues with your supervisor, and you might have second thoughts. You know, I made a mistake. I should have stayed where I was. I thought this was going to be a better situation. It's not turning out. There are issues. So something happened. And it's interesting just viewing the video to see the fact that the report changes. And that's one of the lessons to keep in mind. Earlier reports are simply not going to be accurate. You're going to get more information over time. And right now, the FBI is asking for those that really know this person to call a number. And they provided a number to call. They were seeking information on him. And it's the Navy Yard shooting that I'm briefly going to well, I'm more or less completed what I have to say. And what happened was also response to this was almost predictable. You have the people that I call them the gun grabbers. You know, it's another case of this AR-15, the same model rifle that was used in the killings in that school. Ladies and gentlemen, rifles, pistols are inanimate objects. They don't kill people. You could have them right in front of you, and guess what? They don't get up and point at you and shoot you. It's like a rock. It's like a hammer. It's like a bat. It's like a knife. It's like a book. It's like a car. They're inanimate objects. What kills people is people kill people. So having gun control or hammer control or baseball bat control or knife control is not the answer. There is for many of the people, not all, but many of the people that would want to eliminate your right and my right to bear arms under the U.S. Constitution, the Second Amendment, many of those people would like to do away with it. Now, I'm a strong supporter of the Second Amendment. I will totally resist anyone that's trying to either eliminate the Second Amendment or try to restrict my right to purchase a weapon, whether it's a rifle or a pistol. And I will object to the registration of it. Now, the problem you're into right now is if you go to a gun store and buy a weapon, guess what? You're going to do a background check. And most, if not all, the information that the government truly needs is there. What they're trying to do, and unsuccessfully do, is require when individuals sell their weapons or give their weapons to either a friend, a relative, or, you know, family members, that also a background check be completed. That's ridiculous. You see, to get a complete registration of all weapons, you know, I can go to a store today, buy a weapon, and I'm going to have to go through a background check. Is that, if you're a federal arms dealer, you sell guns, you know, it's a gun rifle store, you're going to have to go through a background check. Now, if you have, man, my mind today is wandering. I think I'm a little bit tired. I know I'm tired. If you're licensed to carry a weapon, a concealed weapon, you've already been through that procedure in terms of they really check out your background to make sure you're not a felon, you're not a criminal. Because, you know, I don't want people that are mentally disturbed, and this gentleman apparently was. He, not too long, I think within a week of this incident, had bought a shot. The problem you have today is many states just don't keep their records up to date. It's very, very hard to be put in a mental institution. And the problem is some of these people, that's where they need to be. And I'm not saying this gentleman, but one time a lot of people were locked up in mental institutions, many of them that shouldn't have been. Now it's very, very difficult to have someone committed into a mental institution for the simple reason, unless the person has exhibited criminal behavior, in other words, acted out, and you need grounds to do that. Now, yes, he might be exhibiting, he might be talking to himself, or not talking to himself, but hearing voices. Usually if you're hearing voices and they're telling you to do something, you have a problem and you need to seek professional help. You need to go to a mental health professional, a psychiatrist, for example, to see what the problem is. And many times it can be treated. Usually it's with medications. And usually once you get the right medication, it can really control the situation. Not always, but many times. The problem you get into there is people have to take their medication. And many times when you have this kind of incident, they haven't. They've gone off the medication for whatever reason. They forgot, or they think they don't need the medication anymore. They go off it, and that's when they get into a situation like today. Now, I don't think mental illness or being addicted to video games is an excuse, not at all. I believe he knew what he was doing. He was responsible for the deaths of 12 innocent people. And that's the tragedy. So I wanted to give you some additional information, because I clearly said yesterday that, especially when I initially found out that there were probably two or three shooters, if there are two or three shooters, this might be a planned attack by terrorists, by Islamic jihadists, or any type of terrorist. Who knows why? Well, that just was speculation on my part, and the speculation was wrong. And there are other people speculated, had other thoughts, if you will, or opinions of what might this situation be. So the takeaway is, wait several days, not just one day, as information comes in. Because when you have so many people killed like this at the nation's capital, they're going to quickly determine, or should be able to quickly determine, what's going on here. You know, one of the things that was a little bit disturbing, apparently someone working at the Washington Naval Yard had lost or thrown away his identification, and it was found near the body of the shooter. And that person apparently had been fired the following Friday, my understanding is he was in jail for some other reason, was released. I think it was drunkenness. When he returned home, he found the police there. Well, they arrested him for driving with a suspended license. And what was disturbing is a couple of the news outlets that were covering the story broadcast his name, thinking that maybe he was the shooter. He had nothing to do with this. He was miles away. But because, my first reaction was, listen, I've lost stuff. Some people lose keys. I know not too long ago I lost my pass to open the gate to where I live. I know what happened. It probably it slipped out of my pocket, and there's no identification information on it. It's one of these where you brush it against a plate and it opens the gate. And it costs $50 to replace. I haven't replaced it, because usually the gate is either open or there's a car about ready to go in, and I just go in right after them. And what's interesting about this apartment complex, apparently I'm not the only one that has lost that car, and last night was probably the worst. There were four cars waiting for someone to drive in that had one of these plastic card swipe things. And once that person came in, I think there are a total of five cars were entering. And that's an aside. But people lose things. And the problem is, I'm sure there have been many, many personnel that have lost keys, identification cards, your driver's license, whatever. Some of it was just carelessness. Some you might have just thrown away. I'm not coming back here. I'll put it in the trash. Who knows? But in this situation, it led to the broadcasting of that person's name early on. Now, that was quickly or subsequently retracted. So that was sort of an aside. Now, what really, I won't say scared me, but you look at the first response, they're all in it. It looks like SWAT team after SWAT team rushed in, and they're wearing military helmets. I call them flak jackets, body armor, if you will. They're sharpshooters. They have shotguns as well as sniper rifles. They were in helicopters, you know, just swarming on. And I understand when you have so many people being shot, there's a concern, and you're trying to get ambulances and helicopters to rescue people. But and what's even stranger is the people were leaving the facility. They were asked to hold up their hands. And I kept scratching my head. I said, well, wait a minute. The people who work there, they're leaving the area, and there are police on both sides looking at them. They're raising their hands. And I still said, why? They don't have weapons, or let's say they're hiding their weapons. You know, maybe they were searched after they've come out, but you have several thousand people there. So I guess what I'm saying, I'm not saying overreacted, that's the wrong word, but it really was stunning to see the amount of first responders, ambulances, police surrounding the area, surrounding the perimeter. Now, there's one thing that I'm really not going to get into, but I need to mention, and I didn't see this, but I've heard this from a couple of sources, both on the radio and on video clips, and in writing. The president, you know, said some words about this, and I have a clip doing it. But when he was finished, he then proceeded to I would call it a rant, a criticism. My feeling is when something like this happens, the president should change his schedule. He should go to comfort the people that, either the hospital, the families that lost loved ones. It should be a day of, call it a not, they have lowered the American flags. It really is not a day to engage in partisan rhetoric. And was, like, I don't have a television at home, but I've been told, and I think this is a reliable source, the networks covered that, and then President Obama proceeded with a very highly critical, and I call it a rant, against the Republicans. I think that's totally, completely uncalled for. He should have canceled the event he was at and gone to either the, again, assuming he's going to have Secret Service protection, so he's not going to immediately go to the Washington Navy Yard until it's secured. I'm not saying he had to do that, but the people that were injured, the people that died and their families were coming, I think it would have been entirely more appropriate that he had gone to the hospital where these people were initially sent to comfort the families and to show that the President of the United States, I put it very simply, cares. It's not a day of partisan rhetoric to be unleashed. And what happened is the networks were covering this, and I think they were right to do that, switched it off. They went back to the major story, which was the shooting. Maybe he'll learn his lesson. I don't think so. I'm very disappointed, but I'm not surprised. The arrogance and poor judgment exercised was, you know, what can I say? And what was interesting, I remember I first learned about this early this morning, and some caller that was black called in, "You're always criticizing the president. Can't you give him a break? You know, what should the president have done?" And the host of the talk show more or less said what I said. The president should have canceled the event when he had first learned of that. Remember, this happened in the early morning between 8 and 9. And should have canceled, changed his schedule, canceled the event, apologized for the people that were coming in to it, and then made a very brief statement to the American people. That was what was appropriate. What was entirely inappropriate and really turned me off, that the president would engage in partisan politics. A very, very big disappointment. And I only mention it because, like I said, I don't listen to television. But I heard it in multiple people who were out watching TV, people that were following this. That was a common comment, if you will. And it's just disappointing. Well, I'm going to move on. I needed to, however, somewhat correct the record on this. A second area that I was hoping to be able to add additional information is on what happened in Benghazi. Now, my understanding is that they are having oversight. The Oversight Committee is having hearings this week. And I thought they were having, as far as I know, they did have hearings yesterday and today, but there's very, very little, there's nothing in the news. I saw no YouTube videos. I saw no articles. So until there's some breaking news, a news event, I'm going to move off Benghazi. Now, there has been another event in the news that you'll probably not hear about, unless you truly follow this. And I'm a little surprised. I haven't seen, again, this is another situation where, at least up to now, I haven't seen any YouTube videos and only a few articles in the paper. I look at many newspapers to just get a feel for what's being covered. The United States today is shipping military equipment and arms to the Syria, or is about to. Well, they've been doing it on and off for at least a year. But they are clearly about to send, or they're concerned about sending, military arms, you know, rifles, pistols, remotely rocket-propelled grenades, shoulder. This I hope they're not sending. Well, they're sending a lot of weapons, again, that were captured in Libya and sending them to the Syrian rebels. Now, here's the problem. Under federal law, it's illegal to make those types of arms shipments to people that are identified as terrorists. And the problem is about half of the terrorists are either Islamic jihadist or, you know, Islamic fundamentalist. And the other half, even though they're Muslim or believers in Islam, are secular. The problem is at least 10,000 or more, and the numbers I'm seeing is there a total of approximately 100,000 Syrian rebels. There's a report that's going to be issued by Jane's. And Jane's is a consultant service that publishes a lot of information on the military, not only of the United States, but the entire world. And they're about to release, I believe it's this Friday, a report that identifies that, well, it's based on a number of intelligence reports. They gathered a lot of information. And the conclusion they have come up with is that there are approximately 100,000 Syrian rebels in total. And that however, out of that 100,000, there are over 1,000 separate groups. I like to call them gangs, but groups, if you will, that these 100,000 are associated with. And 35,000 are considered hardline Islamists, and 10,000 are considered jihadis or jihadists, including Al-Qaeda. Okay, that's part one. And that's a big concern, because about half of these Syrian rebels don't like Christians. They don't like Shia, which is a form of Islam. They are the majority. They're strong in the northern portion of Syria. But if I were over there, they would probably kill me if they found out I was an American or found out I was a Christian. And they have attacked Christian villages in Syria and killed people. These are the people that supposedly the Central Intelligence Agency is shipping arms to. Now, they will be the first to say, no, we're not going to ship arms to groups that are identified with Al-Qaeda or that are jihadists. Well, I understand that, but if you're going to ship, and the numbers I'm hearing, tons of arms to or into Syria, some of these weapons invariably are going to get in the hands of these jihadists. And you're talking roughly about not quite half, just slightly less than half of those Syrian rebels are either, like I said, 10,000 approximately that are jihadists. Those are hardcore. They believe in the violent struggle or war against what they call the Crusaders or Christians. They're not really, they're no friend to the United States or American citizens. And on top of that, you have an additional 30,000 to 35,000 that are not jihadists. They're not Al-Qaeda, but they're really hardcore Islamists. So both groups would favor the establishment of Sharia law being the law of the land, point one. And point two, they would like the establishment of a caliphate or a theocracy. And like I said yesterday, let's assume for a minute that the Assad regime ultimately falls. I'm not sure that's going to happen, but let's say it did. You know, after the Syrian rebels kill the Shia, they're going to have a battle between the competing groups. Like I said, they're over 1,000. There are 9 major ones. So the Jane's report that is going to be officially released, and this firm is located in the United Kingdom, by the way, so it's going to be released this Friday. At least that's the date. Let me see. What's today? 17th? Well, no, excuse me. It's Thursday. I believe the release date for this report is September 19. Now, there have already been press reports in the papers in the United Kingdom, and I've been reading them, and that's where I'm getting this information from. And what is really disturbing to me is I'm not convinced at all that the U.S. military, nor for that matter, the Central Intelligence Agency, really has a firm grip or understanding who are our friends here. Now, I'm sure they think they know at least some of the Syrian rebels, the so-called Free Syrian Army, are on our side and are allies with us. But given the fact that, first of all, these weapons have been promised and delays have taken place, and the fact that the missiles were not launched against Assad, they are not now big supporters of us. And the concern is the arms that we're shipping in will ultimately end up in the hands of people that are not friends of the United States nor friends of Americans. And many of them are terrorists that want to kill us. And what the president did yesterday, or the White House did, was sign an exemption. There's federal laws that prohibit the shipment of arms to terrorists. So he gave a waiver of those sections. I think it's Section 40 and 40A, I believe, is a section of the Arms Export Control Act, I believe, is the name of it. So, and I'm waiting to see more reaction to it. I was trying to do some research before the show. And yes, there are a few articles that are covering it. But again, what is amazing, I'm not seeing it as news stories on the major television networks. I have heard it on the radio, mainly by talk show hosts. I haven't heard it as part of a newscast. And it almost appears, and it appears to me, that Obama, by waiving these provisions of the law, is arming the enemies, the sworn enemies of the United States and the American people. I find that unconscionable. But they're doing it. He's going ahead and doing it. And I hope, but I think this is eventually going to backfire. And many of those weapons are going to be used against American soldiers, airmen, Navy, in the area. Because this civil war will probably go on for, unfortunately, many more years. It's a brutal, savage war with both sides really killing their enemies or perceived enemies. It is very much a religious-based conflict between the Sunni and the Shia. And on the Sunni side, and remember, the Sunnis make about between six, or comprise about 60 to 70% of the population of Syria. And they're strong, they control large areas of the northern part of Syria. Damascus is in the south. And there's been back and forth on this in terms of who controls what and who's winning, who's losing. There's no good side here. The American people, in opinion poll after opinion poll after opinion poll, have said they don't want military intervention in Syria. Now, most Americans simply don't follow foreign affairs. And many of them probably couldn't point on a map where Syria is or identify the major cities or major ports and know next to nothing about the history of Syria. That's why on a previous show, I included in my notes at least slightly less than an hour. I believe it was a BBC. It was a documentary on Syrian history, so at least you'd have some background information. Because most Americans simply aren't interested in foreign affairs unless it somehow affects them. And the way it would affect them, see, at one time we had a draft. Now, we don't have a draft. There's some people in Congress that would like to bring it back. Now, I'm totally against a draft. I consider that involuntary servitude. Now, I served in the military, but it was voluntary. I wasn't drafted. I volunteered to serve in the military, and I spent a little over 5 years in the military. And I'm going to date myself, but I left the Air Force in 1978 in September, right around today. I forget the exact date, but it's very close to right now. So you can see that's 35 years ago. Quite a long time. it was the right decision for me. I initially thought I would make it a career, but I quickly decided that if I were going to make it a career, you had to be a pilot. My eyesight went in high school. There was no way I was ever going to be a pilot. Now, I had what I would consider a very successful career. I stayed in the same location for 5 years. I did want to go over to Europe, but I never could get the orders to do that. And this is sort of ironic. If I had stayed in the military, my next assignment was going to be in the Joint Air Force Navy cruise missile program that was just getting started in the financial management area. Since I put in my papers to resign my commission, and I had more than satisfied my commitment to the military, I didn't go. I had orders to go to what's called Crystal City, which is in a suburb. It's in Virginia, but it's right near Washington, D.C., and near that Washington Navy Yard. That's an aside. And I lost my train of thought. Man, when you get tired, I'm learning something today. Don't get tired and try to do a radio broadcast, because you truly need a focus when you're giving a radio broadcast. And this is about the second or third time my mind has been drifting. I usually know exactly where I'm going, even though you might consider this a stream of conscious. I have a point to make, and sometimes I do make detours. So my concern, big concern, is these weapons are going to get inevitably are going to get in the hands of people that are the enemies of the United States, would kill Americans if they could, and probably will be. And I hope I'm wrong. It's almost like the scandal Fast and Furious, which was another half-baked idea upon the Obama administration under Eric Holder in the Justice Department. The ATF authorized gun store owners to sell to so-called store purchasers arms, rifles, pistols, ammunition, that eventually these store buyers would either take them to Mexico or sell them to Mexicans that eventually would get in the hands of the drug cartel. Now, ostensibly, the purpose of that mission was to identify who they were by tracing the weapons, but they didn't put any tracking devices on the weapons. And even if they did, they probably would be discovered. And they didn't follow the people that bought these weapons once they left the United States. And what happened is several hundred Mexicans to date have died, been murdered with weapons bought at these gun stores. I thought it was the stupidest idea I ever. First of all, initially I said, this is so poorly thought out, and I'm calling it I'll say what I believe. It was stupid. Who thought of this dumb idea? And the ATF agents in the field, they were pleading with their own management, please don't do this. These weapons will get in the hands of people that will kill not only Mexicans, but have a possibility of killing law enforcement agents, which is exactly what happened. There have been two law enforcement agents that have been killed with weapons that came from stores as a result of this Fast and Furious operation. Now, that involved about a little over 2,000 weapons, both rifles and pistols. We're talking tons of arms being shipped into Syria. And it's been handled by the Central Intelligence Agency as part of a so-called covert operation. It's not very covert if most of the world's press know about it. Maybe not in the fine detail that I would like, but it's an open secret that's what they're doing. And there have been articles in the paper indicating that. But this is another half-baked idea. Let's say the overwhelming majority of these people were on our side. Then I would feel a little bit more comfortable. but probably less than half really even like Americans. And they'll tell you anything to get a hold of a weapon and ammunition. They'll take your money. They'll take anything you want to provide them. And initially, they'll go fight the Assad regime. But then when that civil war ends, and assuming Assad is overthrown, they're going to turn around and there's going to be fights between those thousand groups. And unfortunately, the hardliners, the hardline Islamicists, as well as the jihadists, they're going to be killing people that are on our side, the so-called moderates, the moderate Syrians. So I don't approve of what the president did with that waiver. I know why he did it. He didn't want to be accused of arming terrorists, so he waived it. See, if he didn't waive it, he's breaking the law by having the Central Intelligence Agency ship these weapons. And this is a story that I really would have thought have gotten much more coverage on television, as well as radio. I'm not saying it's not getting any, but this is not really getting what I would think the focus, the attention should be. Because although 12 people died in the Washington Naval Yard, hundreds, thousands of people are going to be dying as a result of these weapons getting in the hands of Syrian rebels, many of them whom are allied with us, I understand, but many of them are sworn enemies. And the best way to say it, if they could get a hold of you, if you're an American, especially if you're a CIA agent, they're going to kill you. They're going to execute you. Because they want to turn Syria into another theocracy, just like Iran. You don't have freedom and liberty in Iran. And if they do this, Syria will become very much like Iran. Now, keep in mind, these are Sunnis. They don't like the Shia of Iran. They don't like the Shia and the Alawites in Syria. Again, it's a religious war. But once the Sunnis defeat the Shia, assuming that's what's happening, then they're going to be fighting each another. Because some of the people of Syria, and the administration is claiming the majority of the people in Syria, do not want a theocracy. They want a secular government. I'm doubtful that would happen if the Sunni rebels win. I really am, because assume for a minute that this study is correct, and I have no reason to doubt it because they're really trying to get the best information and summarize it. The numbers look like about 45% of that 100,000 rebels truly want a theocracy or a caliphate. And I'm sure there's some that what we would call moderate Islamists that would probably go along with that. The majority, it looks like it's about 50-50 between the secularists that want some form of government and those that want a theocracy where a caliphate is established and the law of the land is Sharia law. So I was not surprised, but again disappointed in the president doing this. I understand why he did it. It's very much dotting the I's, crossing the T's, because this law is rather specific, as you don't ship arms to terrorists. That's a violation of the law. That is prohibited. Now, the president does have the authority to waive that requirement. I'm not saying he doesn't. And I think once this becomes better known, you're going to see a number of people in Congress, both in the House and in the Senate, challenge this. And I think it needs a lot more exposure. And I'm hoping that will happen when we get the official release of James's estimates of who the Syrian rebels are. See, the problem is most Americans, couldn't find Syria on the map. And even if they could, have no idea. Until I did this research, I had no idea how many so-called Syrian rebels there are, how many groups there are. You know, another disturbing aspect is so many. There's no major dominant force. Now, some are more effective than others, and one of the most effective is a group. I'm going to give you they're called the Victory Front, but they're al-Qaeda related. Al-Nusra. But in English, it's the Victory Front. And I hope and pray they don't get the weapons. But I think it's almost inevitable they will get some of them. And if there is a phase two to this civil war where the Sunnis win over the Shia and then basically fight each another, I think they'll probably get a lot of those weapons. So we need to be very, very careful as to what exactly we supply them. My position is very clear. I want the United States to stay completely out of Syria. I'm a non-interventionist. I don't believe in empires, and that's what the United States has become. We've become an empire, and we're acting like an empire, and the emperor is Barack Obama. He's expanded his war powers with Libya. He didn't have the authority to do Libya. Now, you can get an argument on that, but he's expanded. It's unprecedented, and he's going back on what he said in 2007, and that doesn't surprise me. See, what happens is, whether it's a Republican or Democrat, once they get in power, they want to exercise that power and expand the power. And that's exactly what President Obama has done. There was no authorization from Congress that enabled or permitted President Obama to do what he did in Libya. Now, the president said he didn't have to go. There's the War Powers Act, and we'll get into that in the closing segment with my guest speaker. And I will probably, not immediately, but sometime in the future, revisit this whole issue. Because I'm a strong advocate of the Constitution. And unfortunately, some would go so far to say it's a dead letter. I want to restore the Constitution. I want a limited government. By limited, like I've said in many shows, first we cut it in half, and then we cut it in half again. And that means dramatic downsizing the federal government. Because as we've had war after war after war, the size of the federal government is ratcheted up. And yes, it's going to grow, and there are periods of decline, but it's way larger than 3%, which at one time it was in terms of a percentage of the gross national product. It's over 20% today. And we've run these massive deficits, at least for 4 years in a row, over a trillion dollars, which is $1,000 billion. By the end of September, which is only a couple of weeks away, Barack Obama, in the time has been president, will have added way over $6 trillion. I think it probably, depending on how large the deficit is for the fiscal year that's ending, fiscal year 2013 ends 30 September. I think it's entirely possible that if you add up all the deficits that Barack Obama, since he's been in office, it'll probably hit or be very close to $7 trillion. And the total debt will be over $17 trillion. Most of it, the vast majority, is under his administration. Now, George Bush was a big spender too, but Barack Obama has broken all records. And one area, and now it's not the entire reason for these deficits, are these wars. Yeah, we have an army, a navy, and the air force, but war is expensive. Government intervention abroad is expensive. And as far as I'm concerned, the primary, if not sole reason the United States is in the Middle East is energy, namely oil and natural gas. And I strongly believe the United States is, it's going to, right now, we, the United States, and it's primarily the oil exploration, well, your oil companies, is what I'm trying to say, your drilling companies, are proven reserves of natural gas in particular, but also oil. The United States has become, in terms of both, we have the most proven reserves, and we're going to be an exporter again of that instead of an importer. Now, it's going to take several years for this to happen, and I think as that happens, there's going to be a conscious withdrawal of the United States from the Middle East. Now, Europe, Japan, India, China needs energy, needs oil and natural gas from the Middle East, namely Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Iran. Those are the biggies. You also have Kuwait, Bahrain, but the three biggies by far are Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Iran. So it's still going to be a factor in the Middle East. They're not running out of natural gas and oil anytime soon. But some of our allies in Europe and in Japan will still need those resources. So I'm not saying the United States will totally, completely get out of the Middle East. But I'm hoping we will have a less of a commitment to it. And I think the United States will be forced to do it because of these massive deficits. Because in not the too distant future, what the Federal Reserve has been doing since the December of 2008 is suppressing or compressing the interest rate. And in so doing, indicated by the federal funds rates, which is the rate that banks lend to each other overnight, short-term rate. We don't pay. You can't get federal funds rate. But that's been limited to 25 basis points. Well, what's going to happen is interest rates are going to shoot back up, like they did in the late 70s and 80s. And when that happens, the cost of financing the federal government, these major deficits, are going to go up as well. See, today, interest is in terms of the total budget is about 6%. But if you get a doubling or tripling of interest rates, and it's a term structure in the sense that you have a lower rate for bills, a little bit more higher for notes, and even higher for 30-year bonds, all of those interest rates will move up, up, and up as the Federal Reserve is forced, as inflation comes roaring back. And that's what's going to happen is they're going to have to tighten them. They're going to have a monetary policy that's going to tighten. And that means higher interest rates. You know, I've said this repeatedly, if we had a market-determined interest rates for Treasury securities, the interest rates would be at least 2 to 3% or even more higher than they are today. We don't have, interest rates are being manipulated and controlled by the Federal Reserve, which is a cartel of private banks set up under authorization by the Congress. And in essence, what the Federal Reserve has been doing is enabling the Department of the Treasury to sell Treasury securities at lower rates. So the government that's running these massive deficits, so they can run these massive deficits. Well, that party at some future date in the not distant future, we're talking maybe 1 or 2 or 3 years. All that's going to change because the Fed is going to have to, as inflation rears its ugly head again. And as far as I'm concerned, it already has. You see, the run-up in stocks is largely a Fed rally where you've had low interest rates. But that's going to change as the Fed is compelled to stop inflation. Now, the people that have been, I'm going to have a separate show on the Federal Reserve and the politicking going on, and it looks like Janet Yellen is going to be appointed the next Federal Reserve chairman. I mean, she's the obvious candidate. She's sort of a dove. She's for the continuation of quantitative easing, or the creation of money at a keyboard is the way I call it, DEMS, digital electronic money. She would not be my choice. What's interesting, I had a professor at Berkeley who is the husband, or her husband, that won a Nobel Prize in economics, George Akerlof. Just a detail. And what really needs to happen is the monetary let the market determine the interest rates, not the Federal Reserve. I think this kind of economics, first of all, it hasn't worked, repeatedly hasn't worked. It's what I call a command and control mindset. Virtually all prices in the United States, there are some exceptions, are market-driven, market-determined, except the most, as far as I'm concerned, the most important price, namely the price of money. And that has been consciously manipulated by the Federal Reserve. Because, again, if we had a market-determined rates for money, it would be much, much, much higher. And once that happens, and it will happen, you're going to have a crash in bonds. The bond market will crash. Why? Because existing debt securities, including Treasury securities, are paying too low a rate. So when rates go up and new securities are issued, there's an inverse relationship. So when new securities are issued at much higher rates, those securities that are at low rates, their price or value goes down. So there's going to be a major, major crash in the bond market. And I think you're going to see a similar crash in the stock market for the simple reason stocks typically like either a stable interest rate policy or a lowering of interest rates. They, too, are negatively affected by increases in the interest rate, especially if it's a rapid increase, and I think that's going to be the case. We're going to have a replay of the late 70s and early 80s. It's that simple, and the economy will be going into a recession. I'm looking at the time. I actually went longer than I wanted to. What I'm going to do is we had today at Sabine Hall, we were celebrating Constitution Day. We had a guest lecturer from the University of Texas, which I'll be introducing in a moment, and play the interview or include the interview in as the last segment of the show. It runs a little over 15 minutes, and I'll include it. I just came from an excellent presentation on the War Powers Act. We're celebrating Constitutional Day here at Richland College, and it's my pleasure to have a short interview, about 15 minutes, on the War Powers Acts and the Constitution, and relating that to Syria. We have Professor Edward Harpam. He's a professor of political science at the University of Texas at Dallas. I'd like to welcome you, Professor.
Thank you very much.
Let's really delve right directly in. You offered several solutions to the problems or the issues between the Constitution that gives Congress the power, only Congress the power to declare war, and the War Powers Act. And you offered, I think, four or five. I sort of lean towards solution one, where you revoke the War Powers Act. But I see problems with that, because then you're left with the Constitution that basically says Congress is the only institution that declare war. But there, you really don't necessarily, in many instances, want to declare war. Which is your preferred solution?
Well, the reason I said it was one of my modest proposals or solutions, and I mean that in the Jonathan Swift way of a modest proposal, is the idea that the War Powers Act may have outlived its usefulness and may be creating as many problems as it's solving now. Now, by that I mean, increasingly we view the president as the one who decides where, when, and how we commit U.S. troops, and then Congress is there with a veto, which strikes me, I mean, just one simple way is, I don't see a legislative veto anywhere in the Constitution. It doesn't appear to me the proper role for Congress, and I think the War Powers Act has allowed us to go in that direction, which is to assume a set of roles for Congress that don't make sense. I believe, sort of tied to getting rid of the War Powers Act, which stipulates certain things the president must do if he engages in force, we need to sort of rethink what we're trying to do, and I would argue getting Congress involved more up front and not just consulting where the president says, I want a bomb, but more so, do we have common agreement among our major political leaders, maybe in the major committees in Congress, the leadership, to see if there's actually active support? So I think it's sort of more a rethinking of what you're trying to do with the War Powers Act, but the first step to that would be getting rid of the detailed War Powers Act now, which it's quite clear the president doesn't think is constitutional. Neither party's presidents have thought it was a constitutional act.
Are you aware of anyone in Congress that's pushing for the revocation of the War Powers
Act? No, I think people are talking about it. I think there's a sense of frustration as to what you can do. I think, and you're really seeing now that we saw after the president's initial attempt to go and get a declaration of ability to use force, that Congress said maybe we won't do it. And so the president has effectively withdrawn from that process right now, but he really hasn't changed his overall strategy. My bet is people are concerned about this. It's a real hard one. Now, I might add this. Congress doesn't jump up and down wanting to take responsibility in foreign affairs, and maybe that's part of the problem, too. Mm-hmm. We need a more effective Congress helping to define our interest overseas.
Well, I was interested. There was an interesting exchange between Senator Rand Paul and the Secretary of State, Kerry, when Paul reminded him that, listen, Secretary, the Constitution clearly says it's only the Congress that declare war, but I see no move afoot by anyone in Congress to declare war.
I agree, and I think it would be silly. Do we really, in the talk I also talked about what it means to declare war, would we want to do what you need to do by declaring war, change fundamental relations in foreign affairs, changing contractual relations, international treaties, giving the president authority? Yes, the idea of declaring war might not make sense in these circumstances, but I think the real question is, then what's the proper role for Congress in what I clearly see are expanding U.S. interest overseas or defining U.S. interest overseas. So the Rand Paul thing, I think this is where I think the conversation has to take place away from the immediate circumstances. And isn't that the dilemma? You only change things when you have to change them under political pressures, but an issue like war demand some sort of conversation outside immediate political pressure to say, here's what we think we need to do. Remember, the War Powers Resolution was really a Vietnam resolution, trying to grapple with the problems of Vietnam. Our problems today are Libya, Syria, Iraq, Somalia, all of these extensions of U.S. force overseas.
Well, what struck me is I follow the polls on Syria, and the American people overwhelmingly were against it. Yet you had about 25-26% for intervention, but And polls, you're going to get different results, but it was clearly 2-1, 3-1 against any intervention in Syria. And you got two problems there. You have military intervention, which is overt, which initially it looked like we were going to launch those missiles. And then you also have the problem of covert intervention, which I think is going on, where the Central Intelligence Agency is supplying the rebels with arms. As a matter of fact, I think the president yesterday waived some legislation that he could actually ship arms to terrorists, because by law you can't do that. And unfortunately, about half of the people, the Syrian rebels, are radical Islamists or al-Qaeda associated groups. So I guess what I'm asking is, you could have a president that would totally could have launched the missiles, totally ignoring public opinion. There's a political risk to that. But how would you stop a situation?
Kate, now you'll notice you've added something in that I'm not talking about, which is public opinion.
Right.
My bet is 90% of the American population couldn't point out Syria on a map.
I agree.
So I remember the old Canadian broadcasting company had a comedy show once that asked Americans questions about foreign policy. One of the questions they asked was, Well, you realize President Clinton's campaign in Saskatchewan, they haven't been responding to the bombing in Saskatchewan. Do you think we should intensify it to force them to do what we want to do? And the American people say, oh, yeah, that sounds good to me. They didn't know where Saskatchewan was, nor where Canada was. Mm-hmm. My concern here is not with public opinion. I don't want to take a vote. I want responsible political leaders who are accountable, more than one. I think what you see in Britain going on was a really interesting thing. We talked about this in the talk for a minute. The Prime Minister wanted to declare force, use force in Syria. He went to Parliament, and son of a gun, Parliament said, you don't have the support. Those are people who know. It's not 300 million people. It was a small number of parliamentarians who it's their job to know and to make decisions. So I would, quite frankly, I think when the issue of public opinion matters in the long run, but in a short-term decision about war, I'll trust the Speaker of the House more than I'll trust a survey.
I agree with you, but had Congress voted for that, gave him an authorization to use force, it looked like from, and the Washington Post was doing a daily head count, and it looked like, in terms of the House, forget the Senate for a moment, that it looked like it would have gone down to defeat.
Right, you can do head counts, though, but remember, before the second Iraq war, no one was quite sure how the Senate or the House was going to vote. Mm-hmm. And it's one thing to say, how would you vote? It's another thing to actually vote. And I think that's where, and this is hard to remember, but that's what really congressional discussion should be for, to debate, to think about, to consider and mm-hmm. reconsider. We're so used to platitudes being taken in politics and positions being argued. What about thought and reflection? And I think when you look back at some of those discussions back in, certainly not with the war on terrorism so much because we were attacked, but in your first Iraq war, Afghanistan, congressmen really took it very seriously what they were trying to do. And I think that's what we need. And that's not what we had. I think for Syria in particular, and we talked about this in the talk, but Obama drew a red line. The question is it a red line that the American elite, whatever political elite mm-hmm. that we put in those positions, not just elite, but political elite that have responsible positions, agree with the president on? That's where I think we need a broader discussion. I don't know what that would look like, but surely we need some discussion to change the way we think about those things.
No, I agree with you that I'd rather have a complete airing of the issues, the concerns, before we send any military troops in, or for that matter, I would even go further and say CIA covert operations. But you're well aware that Congress, not only is it not a popular institution, but really doesn't want to take responsibility. They try to avoid responsibility, okay? They're almost letting the president do what he wants. So I agree that you need the conversation, but if the people in Congress, for primarily political reasons, don't want to have it, how do you
this is where I think, though, you could have a mechanism that would compel people to have to make a decision. Mm-hmm. That's what's good about voting, right? You mm-hmm. actually have to make a decision. You can talk about what you do, but under certain circumstances, if you'd have to vote on this in an up or down way, this right. could be very good. I think that's the mechanism we've lost. I'd even say in our politics as a whole, we listen to what Obama's going to do for us rather than ask, what are we doing for us? How are we rethinking this? What are we doing? And I think that's sort of a larger political malady we face, but we're all part of it. I mean, many people aren't even trying to think this through with Obama. Mm-hmm. They're trying to say, well, I think we should, I'm against chemical warfare, therefore let's do it. It's a very complicated issue.
Mm-hmm. No, okay, I got educated real quick because I didn't know anything. I knew very little about chemical weapons, but when I delved into how to destroy them, it's not easy. You got to incinerate
right.
them. And I would, your talk, you made the point that we might have munitions, and I'm very skeptical too because I was in the Air Force, that could incinerate it. The problem is when you launch a bomb, you're not sure where it's going to end, and you could literally open up a lot of weapons, and it's a worst case.
And that's a technical issue, but I mm-hmm. think the question becomes, once again, who decides the overwhelming use of force on behalf of the American people? And I think right now the logic has gone, the president decides and then Congress maybe comes in. I think that's something that we should all be a little bit concerned about, even with the best man. It's not the best men that you worry about, it's the worst men that you worry about. Mm-hmm. And we do have presidents who've just made mistakes or I remember this was, again, I was comparing it in the audience. I grew up in the 70s. I didn't feel at all the same way about Nixon that I do about Obama. And Nixon I was afraid of. He scared me. He mm-hmm. was doing things that I thought were wrong and ill-informed. At least with Obama, I think you have a good person there who's not trying to undermine the constitutional government. But isn't that kind of scary? Mm-hmm. Secretary of State Kerry, is the hardest proponent of using weapons. He's never been that way in any time in mm-hmm. his political career. It's just absolutely amazing. You step into the executive branch and you change the way you act, which we can predict as political scientists and general people interested in constitutional theory, I guess. But it should scare us all. People want to maximize their power, and maybe what we need to do is find ways to limit it and constrain it.
So is the answer, is it a pass as a law, or is it an additional amendment to the Constitution to deal with less than full-out declared war?
Optimally, obviously, the Constitution, because you'd have to go through an overall agreement in the body politic that this is mm-hmm. what we want. It would have to go through Congress, and it would have to go through the states. Mm-hmm. I would think that would be very good. The other thing with a constitutional amendment, you wouldn't have to have the president's approval. Right. You'd be changing something. But let's be realistic mm-hmm. here. What's the likelihood? Not great. Maybe a different structured war powers authorization type thing where you clearly state what you're doing, what you're trying to do. It's just not what the War Powers Act is all about right
and
now.
It sort of sounds like you're advocating, let's say, War Powers Act 2.
I believe in simple things, getting rid of War Powers Act 1, maybe,
yes,
and
yes.
then we'll see where we go, because I don't think it's tenable mm-hmm. to just have declarations of war. Mm-hmm. And even without the War Powers Act, we authorized force in mm-hmm. the past.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't like what the War Powers Act has done, which it seems to ironically legitimate the expansion of the president's power to do these things by saying, well, now Congress approves after the fact.
No, I agree with you, because... Now, the last time was World War II when we declared war, yet we probably had, I've lost count, at least 3 or 4 dozen instances where the United States has used force.
Well, the big ones is Truman. We don't even mm-hmm. go back. Our national story says all the way we've used force over the past 50 years has been generally good mm-hmm. because we made a mistake in the 30s not opposing Hitler. The police action in Korea is a very, very interesting one, a police action, and that's what mm-hmm. Truman called it. Vietnam, Gulf of Tonkin, yes, but... Okay, what were we trying to do, and was it worth what we did? We've had a 50 years of foreign policy under a certain national story, and maybe it's time to rethink what that national story is. It's not inevitable that we increase the power of the executive to commit us overseas. I think that's one thing that we should all recognize. There's nothing inevitable about what we do.
Since we're on a college campus, what I have found, both with the college students and really the American people, and you're probably acutely aware of it, there's not much interest in foreign affairs. It's hard to get their attention. And I've listened to a lot of talk show hosts, and they have the same frustration why they think it's an important issue, we need to know more and discuss it. The American people almost tune out. How would you get, since you're a professor at the University of Texas at Dallas, how would you raise that consciousness, I'll use that term, where the Americans in general get interested in foreign affairs? Does it, I'm totally against the draft, but that would get their attention real quick, and you alluded to that.
I think you have to really recognize that there's a problem here that's built into our system, which is we engage in politics in America periodically as citizens. Mm-hmm. We aren't full-time. We delegate that to our executive and our representatives, because we do other things. In fact, I think the hardest thing for the Americans right now is to deal with tragedy after tragedy after tragedy. We only have so many tears. I think you can have more conversations and the like. I can't imagine any more conversations about foreign policy. I think the failure now isn't simply the American people. I think the failure lies in their leaders who are not properly having the conversation among themselves. The solution is not to mobilize 300 million Americans to discuss Syria. Mm-hmm. It's to get a few members of Congress to have a serious conversation amongst themselves. What are we doing, and do we really want to commit the American people? So I guess I believe in political education, but I also recognize the limits. Do they have to know about Syria, Jordan, Libya, Somalia, South Africa? How many places can we really mm-hmm. expect people to know? I have enough trouble knowing my neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that's the division of labor. I'm not saying to mobilize people or not have education. That's very important. But let's recognize we live in a representative democracy where there's a role for the representatives, and that's the real problem. Is they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing in engaging in this conversation.
I always like to end the interview with where students, as well as faculty or the general public, can get more information on this. Do you have any recommended either a website or a paper that really gives you the background information of the issues?
No, in fact, there are a lot of good websites. If you just Google War Powers Resolution or just Google Simple Statements Commander in Chief, mm-hmm. or Google War Power to Declare War, there are websites being set up to discuss this. And this is where I think there's a lot of place that you can be part of a conversation if you want to. The web is great for that. I think that's not an issue at all. I think the problem becomes many people think they know a lot more about this than they do. And I guess just when you were mentioning public opinion, I think we should rely a lot less in public opinion on something like this and a lot more the basic integrity and smarts of the people we put into office. If we choose bad people, we are in for trouble, whatever public opinion is saying.
Well, I thank you for the interview. I hope you come back to the campus in the future, and if you do, and if I'm still here, I'm sure we'll have another interview in some future date.
Thank you so much.
You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of anyone at KDUX, Richland College, or the DCC. Thank you for listening, and now back to the music.